I've told you about them forever, so you probably already know the names of my three sponsors, right? For example, if I asked you, who's the lawyer that tech entrepreneurs trust because he understands the startup community? You probably know it's Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. And if I asked you, where should you send your friends who want to build online stores? You probably tell me Shopify.com because Shopify stores are beautiful, they're designed to sell, and Shopify makes sure that there won't be any tech support for you to do because they're easy to set up. Finally, if you have a friend who says, hey, I want a phone number, and then if somebody presses one, I want it to go to sales, and two, I want it to go to tech support cell phone number, and three, I want it to reach my home phone number and all that stuff, where do you send them? Of course, you send them to grasshopper.com. Three great sponsors, and now let's start with the interview. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, and the place where I've interviewed over 800 entrepreneurs and heard their stories about how they built their businesses. In this interview, I want to find out how a piece of paper posted on a bulletin board led to a software company that's used by over 30 million customers. As a student, David Yang had an idea for a company, so he posted a simple message on his school bulletin board. I'm looking for a computer engineer. That's what it said. That led to the founding of Abby, a leading provider of document recognition, data capture, and linguistic technologies and services. To give you an idea of what they do, for example, when people hand fill in forms, that many governments and companies use their software to read what they've scribbled on those forms, which is stunning because most people can't read their own handwriting. And here are computers doing it. David, thank you for doing this interview.
Thank you.
You started this because of an idea you had in school about people's reluctance to study languages, right?
Yeah, actually, it was French exam when I came up with the idea to make a software helping people to translate one from one language to another.
And your vision for it was going to be what? What did you think it would look like? How would it work? Before you even posted that note that I talked about, what did you think it was going to be?
Original idea was just to make software which will help people to learn different language, foreign languages, but French language in my case. But then I came up with an idea that if I will do real commercial products, so I should be focused on English language first, and then other languages, and second, probably people use language to understand foreign texts and documents. So rather than to make software which will help them to learn language, maybe it's better to make software which will help them to translate. So first, our commercial product was electronic dictionary translation software.
Oh, it was just a dictionary. You type in one word and you see, and you type in a word in one language and you see it in another language.
Actually, you don't type in, you just capture the a word or several words from your screen. So it was old times when it's DOS operating system, black screen, remember? So we did resident software, which took only 32 kilobytes footprint in memory, and where it was able to capture words from the screen. And actually, it will just help to read. You even don't type, you just move your cursor, and it will give you translation of words.
And what year was this?
It was back 1989.
1989. And so you posted this note on a bulletin board. What was the response to the note that said, I'm looking for a computer engineer?
So if I was a student physicist, I never wanted to give up my physics. Idea was just really crazy. In July to develop the software, in August to sell 100 copies, $100 each, and that's it. And September come back to school. I found a programmer engineer who agreed to do that 50-50, like a venture. My job was to raise money. in 1 month, I mean in several days, and to find a company who will provide us content, translation content. So everything was very quickly in our heads.
When you say translation content, what do you mean? You mean the dictionary?
The idiomatic dictionaries, when you have several words together translated, and different other examples, usage examples, and different other lexicographical data.
Okay. So he was going to develop it. You were tasked with finding money to fund it, and you did. Where did you find money and how much?
Yes. Now I think it's crazy, really crazy. I mean, it's impossible to raise money in 1 week. But what actually happened, not too much money. I mean, it was $3,000 if we convert to current dollars. So one company, today such company should be named as an early stage kind of incubator type. It's post-Soviet time, actually. It was after Perestroika. So we had a lot of talents, engineering and scientific talents, but financial system was completely destroyed. So, but still, Gorbachev organized such kind of early stage youth centers who helped people, young entrepreneurs, to do something new. And it was really interesting. So they agreed just to took my dot matrix printer one page kind of idea business plan and just gave us this money, $3,000. It was enough that time to get a license on content and dictionary content.
And it was a $3,000 loan. And to put it in perspective, you told Jeremy, who pre-interviewed you, what your scholarship was. How much money were you getting from the school?
My scholarship was like $55 a month. Again, it was enough to buy some sneakers, eat, and even go every Saturday, go for disco. So like entrance ticket was like $1 to disco. So
unbelievable. And with 50 some odd bucks, you're able to live. $3,000 is what you get to start your business, and you start to take off from there. But I'm sure the person listening to us is wondering where there was. You were going to the Moscow
Institute of Physics and Technology, MIPT. It's like Russian MIT. I mean, it's the number one institute, university in physics and technology. And people... in order to enter this institute, you should train yourself about 10 years before, just like your part of your life. So, yeah. And yes, so that's what is it?
Where are you from originally? Where's your family from?
My family is from Armenia. My mother is Armenian. My father is Chinese. They both are physicists. They met each other in Moscow State University. I wanted to become a physicist since I was third grade elementary school.
And you got the hard work ethic from your parents. In fact, your father used to talk about how they started. How his family started. Can you tell the audience about that?
Yeah, that was really, really interesting story. Many years after that, I knew that my grandfather started his own business in Shanghai in 1920s. He was a developer. Now we can call that business development, construction, building. But originally, he came from poor family with no money at all. He entered, like he told, with two fists in his pockets and nothing else. And he had relatives who gave him bed and breakfast and 5 cents a day, literally 5 cents a day, just for daytime eating. And but he collected this money in order to buy his first thing in his life, and this first thing was dictionary. He bought an English-Chinese dictionary, and he was working as a hard work, as a worker, labor. And he, but he thought that he can make much more, and he may, can construct buildings. And he bought an English dictionary. He learned English using just dictionary. And he was able to communicate with American and French and other customers who ordered that. And he immediately became higher position among other laborers. And then he became, actually, he opened his own business. And in 20 years, actually, he became quite a big developer in Shanghai.
Unbelievable. And it shows in the decision that he made to buy the dictionary to get another step forward.
Yes, and I never knew this story because I only I all of my life I wanted to become physicist of my parents. And when it happened in MIPT was when I was fourth year student, I started to do that electronic dictionary translation software. I actually was, I had some shame because I thought my parents will never understand me. And but 2 years after, when we had already a thousand, well, at least hundreds, hundred or hundreds of thousands users already. I told to my parents that I think I will give up physics at least for some time, and I will do the dictionary software. And my father then told me this story about grandfather.
Wow. Not only was he not disappointed, this was part of your heritage. No, this is the spirit.
No, he was not disappointed because already at that time we started artificial intelligence software in optical character recognition. We actually had background in artificial intelligence, computer science in our classes since 1995 when I entered MIPT, and we did recognition science and AI, and I was involved with my colleagues who were older than me. So we did this artificial intelligence, and it is mathematics, but it is science, and it is a very interesting thing. So after dictionary, we immediately switched to we started to commercialize and develop own recognition software. Then it appeared in as a find reader product.
So you had the sense that you have an idea, you now have a developer because you spoke to him, he's willing to take this 50-50 split, you're going to develop the product quickly, you're going to sell it quickly. I think the idea was develop it in a month, sell it in a month, go back to school. How long did it take to actually develop that first version?
Actually, it was never, you can never do commercial product in a month. Now I understand. It took us about 9 months to 1 year. So first product we delivered to our customer, a first customer, in 9 months. But it was early, very early version. Then we released another version, more stable. And in a year after that first sale, we had 15 products sold. Not 100 like we wanted originally.
15 copies of the product sold.
15 legal copies sold.
Oh, we're going to get to the illegal part because I see that played a big part of it. But I'm wondering, 15 doesn't sound like as much as you wanted, of course, but it's sales. How did you manage to get your first 15 customers?
direct sales. I took phone book and called organizations, institutes, scientific universities, different structures. I mean, book and just direct sales. I said, we have software which will help your company, your organization to translate. And people were interested, but it was too new for them. It was first half a year, and second half year, actually, it was a different typical phone call conversation. When I called them and they transferred me to IT department, IT department said, you know, I don't know your name, but we already have a Lingvo translation software first. And second, don't tell us that you are developer of the software. They got the software illegally.
Your software, they got illegally. Software.
Yes.
How did they get it back then?
They didn't tell that they got illegal, but they told us that we do have Lingvo translation software on our computers. That's it. We don't need it anymore. And don't tell us that you're a developer. You are probably somebody who wants to us to buy somebody's. We are proud of ourselves that we, in 6 months, every third organization we called, they already had the software. It was like, it was really cool. I mean, but it didn't help us to sell. So 15 copies we sold. Not at $100, but at $700, by the way.
At how much?
So $700.
$700. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So actually we almost did our financial plan. Not in 1 month, not $3,000, but it was kind of still we were able finally to get back the loan and earn some our own pocket money.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely we got big product awareness and brand awareness.
I mean, a lot of it was from people who stole copies of it, but they were aware. So now that you see what's going on, what do you do next? That people like your product, but there's this big risk of illegal copies. What do you do next with your business?
The big challenge we had actually in 2 months, 2-3 months after the idea, after we already raised money, and already started this development, already actually spent this money to the for the vendor or content vendor, then we only realized that actually we are not alone, and this idea already came to many different people, and 10 different ready commercial dictionaries exist on the market. And that was really big mental problem to us, because like we were scared. We were scared that we can't do what we want. But still, we decided to go. We didn't have any chance. And our product became more popular than other products. I don't know why, because of a better interface, which almost didn't change from that time, by the way. And because of content, better content, I don't know. But anyway, our product became much more popular than others. And we understood that first, it is a chance to do something big. Second, in order to make a commercially stable and growing company, we need to understand much more than one product. We can't be one product company. And we understood this concept of drills and holes. We understood that people buy drills not because they want to have drills, but because they want to have holes in the wall. So they buy dictionary not because they want to have the dictionary, but because they want to have translation. So original documents at that time, most actually of the documents appeared to be on papers, in hard copies, in user guides, technical documentations, different. So in people had a very hard time to retype, as you said, or, to retype foreign language sentence in order to translate with software. So we understood what we should put several programs together in one package, which will allow to scan, to check spelling, correct spelling, make very rough automatic translation, word-by-word translation, and improvement with dictionary. So we called this package from page to page, from language to language. We said that now you can press several buttons, put your document to the scanner, press several buttons, and your printer will print out the translation. And it would look like magic. We thought that it will be rough translation. You should check the translation quality first. But anyway, it was so appealing that we increased our sales 10 times immediately.
But you weren't making every piece of this process. No. You were reselling other people's software to make this flow beautifully.
Yes. Originally, we took others' programs and put in one package, and we were resellers and distributors of that. But very, very immediately, we started to develop our own OCR. Having that scientific background and originally many years before in 1980s started this science in our university, we were able in 1 year from 1995 to 1992 to 1993 to release first version of FineReader, which was the quality of recognition was higher than many other existing softwares. And we started to substitute in this package others' programs with ours only after we found the path to the customer. Only when we already built our channels, sales channels, and we understood our customers, we understood their needs, and what features they don't like in the existing software, we understood what to do. It was very important.
I'm wondering a couple of things, how you got those customers for one, but first, how did you know what those customers wanted? I mean, the idea of customers don't want drill bits, they want holes, that's an American understanding, and it's well known within business circles, but you're in Russia. You were at a place where they didn't celebrate business success and teach it the way they teach it here. How did you know it, and how did you talk to your customers to use what you learned?
You know, in 1990s, probably even here in computer science, in IT industry, not many people were so educated. However, you are right that the level of marketing education incomparable was higher here in the US. Well, I think that we were just, we understood many things from our own logic and experience. We read some books, actually. We also had some self-education. And we spoke to our customers. We had, because we were very close to customers, and the brand awareness of Lingvo illegal, we had in 1 year, we had a first year, in the end of first year, we had 50,000 illegal copies. And next year, we had several hundreds of illegal copies. So it helped us to deliver a new product with the same name, Lingvo. But it was a Lingvo dictionary, and the second our package called Linglo Systems.
I see. And you're saying that all the piracy helped spread your name and got people familiar with your software. So then when you created a newer, better version, they at least trusted and knew you because they had experience with your software. So then how did you get those other customers to buy? Was it back to cold calling?
Number of sales still was not dramatically higher. It was like counted of maybe hundreds of sales, but the price of the package was much higher. Now the price together like $3,000 each of the package. So you can imagine if you have even 200 legal packages sold with $3,000 each, you receive kind of already significant revenue.
But it's also a tougher sale to make because you're not well known. People don't even believe you created the software, at least when you sold it at first. Now you have to sell $3,000. How do you get $3,000 software packages sold when you're not an experienced salesperson with relationships and open channels to your customers?
It's that time when everything was like, for us, everything was possible. You know, we were taught in our MIPT mother university that we can do whatever we want. I mean, it's like because of hard work, because of just understanding of the core things, you can do whatever you want. So we never thought that we have some we can't do something. Even when we decided to do FindReader, first idea was, are we crazy? People are, it's so sophisticated computer science and artificial intelligence. How can we compete with that? Okay, dictionary is kind of, it's a database search system. It's a content, but it's understandable. Here, in recognition, it's completely different level.
I see. You're saying that to people who've never seen OCR, optical character recognition, the whole thing just doesn't make sense. Is that right?
No. I was saying that it was for us a big decision to start this development because, you know, our CTO, Konstantin, my schoolmate, he came in 1992 and said, David, we're selling 1 year. We are successfully selling others' OCR system. We were doing that science in our mother university. Why not to just develop our own? And first reaction was, are you crazy? It's like really complicated piece of software, and how many years it will take us to do that. But then in half an hour, it took us only half an hour to sit down, cool down, discuss what we already have, what we already have done before in our classes, and why not combine our existing knowledge with our experience in market. And we decided to do that. In a year, in 1993, we delivered ready product, first version of FindReader. This is the part from R&D. The part of from marketing, again, Lingvo product already was well known to hundreds of thousands of people, and it was in channels. We already built the channels. We had already partners and distributors who sold our software. So the puzzle appeared to be
coming together. Okay.
So,
if we're saying a tenfold increase in sales, we're saying we went from it was 15 sales to 150 sales. But because the price per was so much higher than.
No, I think we just we had partners. We already built this partnership.
Oh, what kind of partners did you get?
Distributors. The market starting to develop itself and become a little bit more mature. So there appear to some companies who mainly sold hardware. They sold scanners or sold computers, and we bundled some software with as a package. So sometimes people bought complete package, scanner, computer, printer, and our translation software together, like ready to go from page to page, from language to language solution.
Do I understand this right, too, that back then to copy your software, to pirate it, people would have to basically copy multiple disks, which would take an hour or more, and they had to walk it from place to place. And so if you create a package of multiple pieces of software, for someone to pirate now, they have way more work to do and way more disks to keep straight. And so it reduced piracy or the ease of piracy?
It affected it. Lingua package was 10 disks, actually. 10 5-inch disks, 512 kilobytes each disk. So 10 disks also takes some time to format and copy. Yes, you write that all package together with OCR, spell checking, and other, it was like 15 or 20 disks. So yes, more difficult. Most people still did this. They cracked our protection, copy protection part, and they still did this copying. But again, we understood how to make sales right, how to get to right departments, how to sell the solution, hardware, software together solution, how to talk to partners. So it's not, 100 copies is still so small amount, then you can do that. When you are saying about 100,000 copies or 1 million copies, then it becomes a different story.
One use of the software, from what I understand from your conversation with Jeremy, was you started calling scientific institutes. They were starting to buy computers, but the computer manuals that came with the machines that they were buying were in English, and they needed to translate them into their local language. And so you said, these guys are going to be perfect customers for us. They already have the computer. They need to know how to translate, and our software will do it for them. In the beginning, you had this belief that you can create software quickly. When it's just you and your partner saying we can create software quickly and it takes you 9 months or 6 months instead of 1 month, that's fine. What happens when it's a customer, like a scientific institute, and they're expecting software to come within a short time? It takes you longer. Do they get upset? Do they start to cancel? Do they start to spread bad things about you?
We didn't make custom software. We never did custom software. We made standard shrink box software. So our first customer, yes, they had to have some patience, because the very first customer, they bought 3 copies from us in September 1989. And they had to wait 6 months because we failed to deliver the software on time. And they waited 6 months, and finally they got the software. But we were lucky that they had this patience. We just gave them discount and apologized and said, and they believed that we did our best. So, and they, I think they bought more later. So
early adopters are the best. They know that they're cutting edge and they're willing to accept some.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Thank you to early adopters. They do have this kind of loyalty. Otherwise never happened.
So then I understand how you went to a dozen or so customers, or sales, then hundreds. How do you make the big leap? How do you go from doing hundreds of sales to thousands and hundreds of thousands? That's a step that many people never get to take. What did you do?
Yeah. Of course, our strategic decision was to go internationally. We, in 1994 and 1995, we understood that our software today, I mean, FindReader, first of all, recognition software, is better, has a higher accuracy of recognition on many comparative tests, not only on local language, but even in English, in comparison with well-known brands, international brands. So, and understanding that we are now in the quality of recognition are very, we are matching international standards, and sometimes even higher, even better, gave us idea why not to present the software, say, in the US. And this was, of course, big challenge because US market is tough, is very much specific to customer needs and distribution channels. We met our future partner Ding Tang, who was owner and founder of its own OCR company called Newsoft, and he was competing with quite well in the US with his own software, but his software was not number one. His software was among three of best.
You're saying that because you were so far superior to the competition, that people were more likely to buy you as they were understanding what they wanted.
We were not so, so better. We were a little bit better, but it was not enough. Just the difference in quality was not enough to make a decision, immediate decision, to in our favor. So it was a problem of just building channels again and partnerships. So we agreed with Dean that he will substitute his own product with our product. It's like it will be a private label. So we will change FindReader name to his brand name, which was Presto OCR. But the product will remain the same. So he will sell FindReader under his name and start competing with, he already had channels, but now we give him better quality of a product, and it was a successful strategy. He immediately became very, very well-known OCR software in the US, but later on we decided that he will switch to our name. So FindReader appeared on American market with a good competitive environment.
Why would he give up his name and give it to you when it seemed like that was the last piece that he owned?
I think it was very smart decision from Ding. He has this explanation in Chinese, is Chinese have you know, strategy of martial strategy. It's the when they, but anyway, I think that he understood that if he always will just be reseller of somebody's product, he will always be on second-tier positions. So you can't build your big strategy just relying on one vendor.
But then doesn't he become second tier forever by handing you both the product and the name? So essentially he's just reselling your product. It no longer is Presto OCR being made by him. It's not even Presto OCR and definitely not a software either.
Yeah, because he became a part of our company.
Oh, I see. You acquired him.
Yes, it was merging between us. And I think it was very important strategic decision from both of us because we shared and he shared, we both shared our experience. He shared his experience in marketing. We shared our experience in technology. And very, very quickly, FindRadar became leader, one of maybe two, three leading systems in the US. And then very similar merger appeared in Europe with our European partner. Very similar merger appeared in Eastern Europe. So actually we had by 2000, we already had four or five international presence, international offices and subsidiary companies.
Through these kinds of mergers.
Yes.
You started the company in the early days, you were working with your wife. Is she one of the founders?
Yeah, she joined the company, I think, third or fourth person in the company.
What's it like working with your wife in those early days when it's nonstop work and you're living with her, you're working with her? People, were they coming into your house at the time to have meetings with you? Tell me about what was it like?
Our first office happened to be in our apartment, which we rent. So we were students, and we didn't have our own real estate, and we rent. And our first office was right there where we lived, and vice versa. We rent another apartment later, two bedroom apartment for our office, and we actually again we lived in one corner with my wife and all of that in the office. And people, our customers came to there to buy our software, and another person made pizza in the kitchen during the lunch. And it was like really funny, a funny place to leave work and talk to customers. So it was.
Was it stressful on the two of you, or is it the kind of situation that can bring you together?
I think no, it was not stressful. I think I don't understand people who say that you shouldn't work with your wife. You should work different in different companies because otherwise you. Like I heard that otherwise you don't have topics to talk during the evenings.
You're always talking nights. About work, and you've talked about it during the day, so you've exhausted that one topic that you have.
Yeah, well, I think we were exhausted to talk about work during the day. So when we became alone, we just spoke about literature. About music, about movies, but frankly not so much time we had, spare time we had. We first vacation, I mean not vacation, even holidays, weekend days like Sundays and Saturdays. Actually, we had only. After 2.5 years after we began.
Oh, so it wasn't, you didn't take a holiday until, years, wow.
We solved first 2 years, we neither had just normal holidays, 1 week, 2 weeks holidays. No, we even didn't have weekends.
Wow.
we were working even Saturday and Sunday. That was, it's true. I mean,
do you remember earning your first $1 million in sales?
Yeah, I mean, it was somewhere in 90s, but no celebration, I think.
No celebration. Why not?
No. It was I don't know why. I mean, we just...
You just continue with your business.
We continued what we were doing. We were developing new things, and just once we opened our Excel sheet and said, wow, actually this year we exceed our revenues. Our revenues exceed $1 million, but I don't remember we did celebration.
What happened when the financial crisis hit Russia in the, what was it, late 90s?
Yeah. In 1998, it was a big financial crisis in Russia, and the stock market went down like five times or enormously. And revenues of most IT companies went down about two times. Immediately, the only way to survive most companies, actually what they did, they laid off people. But we were lucky, and I think it when it was another story, time when we improved our positions, we didn't fire with anybody. Just we were able to keep everybody in the company. Not because our revenues didn't decline. Our local revenues declined as well. But first, we had some revenues from international revenues, which helped a lot. Second, we had very high loyalty from our people and our team. And we just said that, guys, this is our financials. Our local revenues declined two times. But we can't pay the same amount of salary as we normally pay, but we can pay only half. But we promise to give the rest part, the second part of the salary, pay back someday with 6% annual interest. We don't know when. We can't promise the date and year we can pay back, but we promised to do that as soon as we can. And it's your decision whether to leave the company or to stay with the company. Whatever you will decide, even if you will leave in a year, we still will pay back all the 50% we owe you. And people, nobody left, just nobody. Everybody stayed with the company. It was 1998, and we paid back all the loans to our people in 2000, in 2 years.
Wow.
With 6% interest. So I understood that the team is something which really number one in factor if in your in the business in your success.
I want to ask about one other setback, and then maybe talk about this interesting hobby that you've got that I didn't expect when I read about you. But the other setback was earlier on. You bought a dictionary that had a problem, right? Where you ended up having to type without using the letter K. What happened there? I don't know the full story.
It was the first 1989 when we just developed the first version. I told that we borrowed $3,000 in order to pay for the content.
Right.
And the company who provided the content, they failed in terms in time. They delivered the content in 8 months, not in 1 month. But when we got this about 20 discs of the content, and we couldn't check all 10, 20 discs, we paid, we got, and when we opened the discs, we understood that the K letter is missing.
So what do you do K. when K, an important part of the alphabet, is missing? We're not talking about Z.
It was a big part of the dictionary. Well, we had about 1 week to before the shipping date to our first customer. The first customer already was waiting 6 months, and we promised that like in a week we will deliver everything to you. And then we understand that we don't have K. And in a week, every night, me and my partner, we just took two fingers because we didn't type that time. Now I type 10 fingers. Yeah. But then I didn't. And in two fingers, every night, we spent and typed this K letter and we didn't sleep. I mean, almost didn't sleep 1 week.
No, it's an amazing story. People who aren't entrepreneurs say, well, these guys who start their own companies, they have no boss, life is good, and they don't realize there are problems like this. And then when we start off as entrepreneurs, when we come across an issue like this, it's very easy to say, oh, I am no good. I couldn't even make a deal to buy a dictionary. Somebody else was way better than me at this. But of course, that's the wrong attitude to take. You said, oh, we've got to find a solution. Our solution will be to manually sit and type. If that's what we can do with only two fingers, that's what we'll have to do. I also want to know why you're not at the company. But first, I said that you had this interesting hobby. Mobs. What kind of mobs are you creating? Obviously not the kind of mobs.
Flash mobs, yeah. Yeah, no, I left Abbey in 1998 as from CEO position.
You still controlled you still stayed as a man in a chairman of the board, right? Position?
Yeah, I'm still chairman of the board. I am a shareholder, but the company grew up, and I have very successful partners who started company with me, and I decided to start a new project called Cybico. It's a handheld communication computer, which allowed teenagers to meet each other, find each other. It's a boy can enter information about yourself, himself.
I wish I could show people an image of it, because we'd recognize it if we saw it. It's looks like a rectangle with jagged edges that kind of resemble the fingerprint holders that people could type on. It was, I remember seeing it. I remember blogs talking about it. I think it was.
Yeah,
blogs.
It was. We developed this radio protocol and operating system and hardware. We developed everything. First year we sold in year 2000, we sold 250,000 units. In the U.S., and people recognized us in the streets, and it was really big buzz. I think this chat, local chat, and the friend finding feature, it was a first kind of attempt to build location-based social network. No such word, social network. happened that year, but that time, even no texting, but still it was very funny. Then local U.S. Economical recession and NASDAQ crisis happened in 2000. So we, the project Cybico, we decided to discontinue and to reorganize. So after my Cybico project, I had some spare free time to finally have some rest, sleep, because Cybico was so tough. So no sleep at all went again. And that time I found that this very interesting thing happens, flash mobs. And we did our first flash mob in 2 or 3 months after first flash mob happened in Macy's in New York. It was, I think, year 2002 or 2003. And we, since that time, we conducted 50 flash mobs. Three of them were international flash mobs, where thousands of people from 30 countries, 130 cities participated simultaneously. And it was a great time.
And this was just for fun. I wouldn't have expected that the founder of such a big company would be organizing flash mobs. I would have thought it would be an artist or a student.
Well,
why do it?
It always was my hobby to computer science and physics is my profession, but I always had a hobby in visual arts and performance arts. I did several performances and happenings during my school university. And flash mobs is a combination between high tech and modern contemporary communication technique and performance art. So it was so interesting convergence and combination that I couldn't miss it. I mean, I was so intrigued how people socialize, how people communicate, how people come together, come up with scenarios and conduct that. So, yeah, it was a hobby. I mean, it was really fun and hobby just because I had about 1 year just to having rest and doing just and relaxing.
Like a fun way to spend a year.
Relaxing. After Cybico.
What size revenue is Abby doing right now?
We're a private company, so we unfortunately not disclosing the revenues, but people can estimate our revenues with the numbers we open. Say we're saying that we have 2,000 people, 2,000 employees in 14 offices in 10 countries. So,
can we estimate over 10 million with those numbers? Excuse me, over 100 million with those numbers?
Again, I mean,
what I mean is, can you give me the neighborhood without getting anywhere close that it would be that a competitor would know? Give me even like a broad range between what and what? 50 and 100? You can't even say that?
No. I mean, some people know our revenues very well.
I know, and they must be laughing again, that that's my guess.
We're big enough, but we're growing so quickly, and I think that as soon as we will potentially, who knows, be at IPO position or some other position, we will disclose our figures and our financials. But we grew up 10 times in 10 last years, for example. And
Actually, here's what I see here. I should have done this before. I don't know what's wrong with me. According to Harvey Spencer Associates, estimates the volume in this market 2011 was around $2.4 billion. That's the market. Annual revenue for market leaders can be put in at several hundreds of millions of dollars. Abby's revenue jumped 46%, and then it gets cut off. I should have bought the press release. That's what happens when you don't pay. Well, when you don't pay, you don't get to know. I should have paid for it before we started. I didn't even think to look.
It's okay. I mean,
yeah.
We are growing very fast, and any number which even good estimation sometimes become lower than actual appears, because I think that very soon we will disclose all our figures, and but we definitely are today in strong international positions and in data and document capture, and and by the way,
I could see you guys are doing exceptionally well. I'm looking at all kinds of numbers here online that I should have looked before, but really it's not about the revenue number. This isn't a stock trading show. Well, thank you, Reporter Link News, for giving me clear understanding here. Clear, but not clear enough. So what I'm going to do is instead is say, you guys clearly are very successful. I'm going to wait for the IPO to find out exactly where your revenues are. Next time I'm going to do my homework. And I usually do. I would have thought that I would have looked this up already, but I don't have that data. But it is an incredible story. One of the best parts of it that you said your grandfather started off with two fists in his pocket, meaning no cash, but the willingness to fight. I love that willingness. And congratulations on everything that you've done with that fight. Thank you all for being a part of this interview. The company, of course, is Abby, A-B-B-Y-Y. Bye.